Thank you. Okay, let's welcome our first speaker, Ashley J from Cambridge, to talk about the three legacies of AI.
Wow, good evening. That was pretty good. I'm from the South. Let's try another take. Good evening. Oh, that feels so much better. Thank you, Katie, for all of your remarkable service as the chair this year of the Freedom Trail. And I am an alcoholic. My name is Ashley. Hi, everybody. Isn't that just musical? It sounds so good. I want to thank the committee as well as Katie. It's an honor and a delight to be asked to speak. I have no idea what I'm going to say. As one of my friends has said in the past, it's going to be, we're on a discovery mission with higher power. I have a sobriety date. It's the 30th of December, 2006. And I have a home group. I'm not there as often as I would recommend you attend your home group. It is the Beacon Group, and I have a sponsor, and she's in the room tonight, and she is very dear and very special, and she is a powerful, empowered woman who lives the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I also have the honor of sponsoring women. I try not to call them my sponsees. They're not my little anythings. They are grown-ass women in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have the pleasure of walking beside, and three of them have come in from very diverse parts of the country to be here, and I'm very blessed by their presence, and I have a special friend locally who's also come in, and all of you are also special to me, so let's have some fellowship this evening. So the talk is allegedly about all 36 principles, and what I would like to do is tell my story and weave in how the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts of service, you know, it says we're willing to go to any lengths, and I try to go all the way to the general warranties of the conference in the 12th concept. It was kind of supposed to be a joke. In practicing these principles in all of my affairs, because I grew up with a lot of hurt, I grew up with a lot of pain, I also grew up with trauma and violence, and I want a way of life today that has freedom. And that's one of the core questions I ask myself in AA is how free do I want to be? And I've heard other people talk about that with the fourth step, and I don't want to just stop with my fourth step. I want to go as far as I can go with all 36 of these principles. So because this is about all of the legacies, I want to start with something that I typically don't really unpack, but I want to start with how I introduced myself, which is by saying, I am an alcoholic, my name is Ashley. And so why do I do it in that order when we know that Bill Wilson, when he was at the Mayflower Hotel, put a coin in the telephone and said, hi, my name is Bill and I'm an alcoholic. So why do I have the audacity to reverse that order? And for me, it has something to do with the traditions. Because I believe that when I tell you I'm an alcoholic, you know everything about me that you really need to know. Number one, I meet the third tradition, which is the requirement for membership, and I have a desire to stop drinking. I tell you that I am an alcoholic. And that I'm here to support our singleness of purpose, which is the fifth tradition, and to maintain my sobriety and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. I also know that my profession is an outside issue, and so I'm here to maintain non-professionalism, which is the eighth tradition, because it says that AA should remain forever non-professional, and that not only includes the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we don't get involved with professional pursuits, but that we as individuals come in as non-professionals. Our 12-step work is non-professional. We don't exchange money for sponsoring, but that my professional status is irrelevant when I get here, as is my class, if I came on the bus, if I came from a shelter, if I came in any other kind of car. And then also power, property, money, and prestige, you know, which we talk about in the sixth tradition. All of that is irrelevant. I'm an alcoholic. I told you that when I stood up. And then, of course, in the 12th tradition, we talk about anonymity being the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. And my name can be an outside issue. It can be a distraction. And so I'm trying to put the principle of my alcoholism before my personality, because our names represent our personality. And so I just wanted to share that that's why I do that. And that's I feel very comfortable with that. So there's a little explanation, and that may resonate with you, and you may think it's a bunch of hooey. And so that's diving in a little bit to the traditions and how I try to be thoughtful in my application of them in my introduction. So I got to AA on the 6th of February in 2006, which is a mismatch with my sobriety date, because we're at MIT and we can do math. And I got here because, you know, we all get here in different ways in these modern times. And I have a sibling who I just thought liked to snack. It turned out that it was called an eating disorder. And she went to treatment. She was the first person in our family to get real bona fide sort of professional evidence-based help. And when I went to support her in what was called a family week, they looked at me and they said, don't walk, run like heck to the Al-Anon family groups. And I was like, well, she snacks, my papaw drank. What does anything of that have to do with me? And they knew what they were talking about, and they also observed the eighth tradition and that they separated out their professionalism from their individual membership and 12-step program. But somebody did 12-step me, and they also suggested that I stay for inpatient treatment as an adult child of an alcoholic family system. They said, your pain looks different, but you come from the same woundedness. And that really got me. And when I came out of treatment, I did go to our sister program, but I, at my first meeting, shared non-conference published literature because I didn't know any better. And it was a healthy and principled meeting, and so of course I was corrected, so of course I got a resentment, so of course I wouldn't go back to Al-Anon, so of course I came to AA. And what happened was, you gave me alcoholism because it can be contagious. And I did have a sponsor, and that's a beautiful story, and she told me to go to at least 2 literature meetings a week. And because I was going to literature meetings, and I knew that the solution was found in the literature, because I had lived with a lot of problems and I was kind of tired of them, I started to identify with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And also because, like Bill says, in the 12 and 12, I was tortured by loneliness. I loved to read the stories in the back of the big book as I was falling asleep at night, because I found them very comforting and they all have happy endings. And I identified with things such as in the story, My Bottle, My Resentments in Me, where this fella says his beard would have reached his belt if he'd had a belt. And I thought, well, what did this hobo and I have in common? And his sponsor said to him, it's not how much you drink, it's what happens when you drink. And because I kept reading the book, all of these things were speaking to me in my 3 glasses of white wine and the cheese, because I'm a white wine and cheese kind of alcoholic. And then I read in the book that it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker that one day she can control and enjoy her drinking. And I thought, oh, dang it, they really got me on that one. So read the literature. It has so much in it that is about that identification. And I felt kind of different from you, and I was treated very differently when I came in. And it doesn't make anybody bad and wrong. It just was the experience that I had in the Franklin Noon Group that was meeting in Franklin, Tennessee. And I've worked all that out with them, and they're my brothers and my sisters now. But, you know, the women would take a big book and write down their phone numbers and pass it around to any new woman who came in. And the women didn't do that for me when I came in. But there were a couple of old farts who were really good to me. And I'm still grateful for them, because they kept me coming back when I otherwise didn't receive a particularly hospitable welcome. And I want to talk about the sponsor that I did have, because this goes back to childhood. And I said I grew up with the family disease, but that does not mean an alcoholic make. But I want to tell a little bit about that story and then, you know, make sure that we talk about the allergy and the phenomenon of craving, the obsession with the first drink and the phenomenon of craving. My great-grandmommy was an alcoholic. She died on the streets. She was a flophouse drunk, and she was an arsonist and a murderer. That's what alcoholism looked like in my family. And my folks had a secret growing up, and as we've often heard in these rooms, we're only as sick as our secrets. And they were really doing the best they could, and that's really blithe to say when you're hurting the way I was hurting, but thank God for steps 8 and 9, and we'll get to that. You know, but what divorce looked like in my family too was, my mom stole me from my dad. My dad bought me back for $2,000, because that's what the going price for a child was in those days. And then when my dad tried to come get me to go to have a visit with me, my mom hid the car in the barn and turned off all the lights and pulled down the shades and hid me under the bed. And he ran around the house cussing and trying to break down the windows. So that's just a snapshot of my childhood. And I left out the part where I lived alone for 2 years as a kid without any adult supervision, without a neighbor, without someone walking a dog on a routine, noticing that there was this hungry kid left alone in a house, except for my next door neighbor, Maureen, who apparently had a washer and dryer, which was convenient for me because I had a bunch of dirty clothes and I had a lot of teenage pride and I didn't want to go to school dirty. And I noticed that this neighbor who had on a bikini, which wasn't the part that impressed me, she was reading a big book, a fat book. And I thought, oh, she's smart, as well as smoking, which meant she was sophisticated. And I figured out what patio went with what front door, and I went over to her door and I knocked on it and I said, hi, I'm Ashley, could I please do my wash? And she said, well, hi, Ashley, come on in. And what I came to know was at the time Maureen S. had 7 years of continuous sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And her sponsor, she felt like a failure in the sweepstakes relationship of life because she had just gotten a divorce in sobriety. And her sponsor had just suggested that she learn how to love for fun and for free. And Maureen, who now has 48 years of continuous sobriety, to this day tells me that I was her gift from God. And she took me in that year that I was living alone, and she let me watch Cinemax, because she was rich, and listened to my woes at school. She taught me how to roast a chicken, and she let me sleep in her guest room when the utilities were cut off at my house because my dad wasn't paying the bills. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous looked like to me when I was 15 years old. And I didn't know anything else about recovery, but she did say there's probably a problem of alcoholism in your family. And I said, well, do something. And she gave me my first 12-step lesson. I can carry the message, but I can't carry the person. And so she became my first sponsor. And it was a beautiful thing. And it still is a beautiful thing. We're really close and we spend a lot of time together. And you know, she obviously would have done things differently back in 1984 had she known more about Child Protective Services and all, and we've had those conversations. And when I spoke at AA in Women's International, she introduced me, and I was embarrassed because she had so much time and I only had 17 years. But, you know, God does interesting, good work, and I told her I was ashamed that she was introducing me, and she said, you have a message that night that someone out there needs to hear. So that's Maureen. And maybe she'll speak here sometime. So when I started working the steps, I wrote out a history of my drinking and my attitudes toward alcohol because they were very distorted. You know, alcoholism was ugly, as I described in my family, and so I dressed mine up. I put a ring on it. I put a pretty dress on it. I made cocktail menus. And then I made myself get sick because I didn't want to have a hangover, and I had these quasi-religious experiences with beautiful, profound insights that I wanted to share with people, but how could I, because I was in a hotel room alone. So I did the natural thing and called and left myself voicemails. And then when I listened to the voicemail the next day, I was like, what is this gibberish? What is this nonsense? And I thought, oh, that's me talking to myself drunk. And my sponsor said to me when I read my first step, Ashley, that is not sane behavior. So I landed at step two. And I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that all of us are given the privilege and the dignity of a God of our own understanding. And it is enshrined in our preamble that we are not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, institution, or organization, that that is protected in our traditions. And it is never open to criticism, conversation, or contempt, that all of us are given this lavish freedom to connect with the intimacy of a God that is fundamentally inside each and every one of us. And my experience is that my higher power is in me like butter is in milk, like the light flickering inside the flame of a candle. And it is so intimate and it is so reciprocal. And I want to tell you a second step story. And I've had lots of second step experiences, and I've connected them with the traditions and an informed group conscience. It is an informed group conscience. Everyone needs access to all the same information, or it's not. I think it's really it doesn't include participation if not everyone has access to the same information, which is concept four. It sets people up to have conflict. It's abusive to cut some people out. It's not egalitarian. We are a fellowship of equals. The first word of our first step is we. It's not democratic in thought and action, which is included in the 12 and the 12th concept. So the second step very much inheres in our traditions and our concepts. But this story that I want to tell you, I was in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo in Central Africa, where I spend a considerable amount of time. And my story includes a lot of violence, so please take care of yourself if something comes up for you. And I was with girls and women who are survivors of multiple gang rapes by armed militia. And that particular night, I had really had my fill, and I was pretty shattered. And I was in my hotel room, and I had dropped my basket, as we say in the South, and I just could not stop crying. I was unzipped. And I thought, this is a second step situation. I need to find a higher power with whom I can connect so I can settle and soothe and I can go back out, because how can I best serve thee? I need to grow in understanding and effectiveness. How can I best serve thee? And so I thought, institutions, politics, you know, I need a higher power that's bigger than colonialism, mass rape, conflict, mineral mining. I was getting really big and really heady about it all, you know, bigger than the news headlines, and it wasn't working. I was getting more hysterical. And it was the second step dilemma. You know, God is everything or God is nothing. And I had a little envelope with me with which I traveled, and I had some little talisman in there. And I just randomly opened it up, and out fell a picture of, naturally, my kitty cat. And my kitty cat, my mom had cut it for me, so it was just itty bitty, you know, just cut his little silhouette. And this was Percy, and Percy is a great beauty, and he knows it. And I started thinking about how Percy shared a pillow with me. And he would curl around my head and then proceed to give us both the bath of the century. And he loved me. And then I would start to feel worried that I wasn't going to get enough sleep. And I would worry about putting him out, and he would have his little sensitive feelings hurt. And then I would go ahead and put him out, and then I would open the door in the next morning, but he wouldn't have a punishing bone in his body. Just pure, I love you, I'm so glad to see you, with those winking eyes. And I thought, that's my higher power. Just wants to curl up with me right here, right now, on this pillow, and love me in my brokenness, be with me in my despair, and cherish the desires of my heart to be with other people who have bloody knees and are trying to do something worthwhile, and that I am precious in my wayward ways and known in the devastation of my heart. And I don't need to add anything or take anything away, but just be here with the God of my understanding. And I stopped crying, and I settled and I soothed, and I just curled up in that bed with my pillow, and I held my own hand, because I realized that my higher power was in me already, like butter was in milk, and like the light of a flame, like the light inside the flame of a candle. And then I saw this prayer that was inside my little leather pouch, and it said something to the extent of, I don't know where I'm going. I don't see the road ahead. I have no idea where it will end, nor do I really know myself. But I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope I have that desire in all that I do. And I got up the next day, and I went about my business, and I put one foot in front of the other, because I remembered what I'd learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm in the footwork department and not in the results department. And I've had many other such second step experiences, both in places like Eastern DRC and hotel rooms in New York City, wet and naked and totally surrendered on the floor, just total surrender. And in step three, when I get to make that decision, I really think about concept three, which says the right of decision makes effective leadership possible. Because concept one, which talks about how the AA groups have the final responsibility and ultimate authority for AA as a whole, teaches me that I'm responsible for my own life. And I start that responsibility by working the 12 steps, which carry me toward a spiritual awakening, the end of which I can see, feel, hear, and do things I previously could not do. You know, it's this profound shift in consciousness. So when I turn my will and my life over to the care, not the power, control, dominion, the care, I love this operative word in our steps, of a higher power, I can make decisions with which I can be at peace. You know, because we talk in the 10th step promises that by then sanity will have returned. And we talk so much in step 11, and Arisa's going to address this. It talks about thinking like 12 times in those paragraphs. I can trust my thinking. And I have the right to make good decisions for myself. You know, and it talks in concept 9 about good personal leadership at all service levels is a necessity. I'm the leader of my own life. I can trust myself today. And if I need an informed group conscience, which is different from polling everybody, I have trusted people with whom I can reason things out. You know, and I made a decision once that was pretty consequential and had broad social implications, and I totally used step 3, concept 3, and concept 9 when I made that decision. You know, I did my due diligence. I spoke with people who were experts in their fields because our service centers have special workers. So I consult with people who are experts in their field. And then I go inside to my own conscience and consult there, because in reality, I've already made the most important decision I'll ever make, which is to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand her. So I went on a run. I remembered that decision was so easy, it was just the right thing to do. And then I went to the woods and hiked by myself for 5 days because the world's reaction really had nothing to do with me. It was about other people dancing with themselves because I had already danced with God. So in step 4, when I do this inventory, you know, because I've stepped on the toes of my fellows and set into motion trains of circumstance I felt I didn't deserve, and then they retaliate at times, you know, to me this really resonates with common welfare and unity. And we talk about selfishness and self-centeredness. So where do I have the balance between I matter as an individual, which the 12 and 12 talks about so lucidly on that second page in the chapter of Tradition 1. I matter so much as an individual, but so does the group. And I as an individual need a healthy group in which to recover, and the group needs to be healthy in which to support the individual organism. So when have I participated in ways that were healthy and appropriate, or when have I isolated? You know, my sponsor's big on short, successful visits. And I live in a household with mixed cultures and mixed nationalities. My partner is Swiss. His daughter's Swiss and German. They speak Swiss German as a language. I speak English. My participation has not been a key to harmony in acquiring their language. And when I do my 4th step inventory, I'm constantly looking at Tradition 1. Where am I supporting common welfare? Where am I taking care of myself, and where am I being selfish and isolating? And this obviously goes in my 10th and my 11th steps as well. So just think about that. You know, in the first question with the Tradition 1 inventory from the grapevine is such a beautiful question. Am I an integrating and healing presence? I just love that. I think that's such a beautiful question for reflection. And I also want to mention that, you know, sometimes I can overdo it, but sometimes I underdo it, and I place myself in a position to let people hurt me. And then I am participating in my own harm because, we say that we've ceased fighting, but that doesn't mean that I'm a doormat. And it doesn't mean that I don't have voice because, I think that participation is such a key part in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we also have to look at concept 5, which says that we have a duty and an obligation. That's the language. We have a duty and an obligation when we are the minority voice to speak up. So I want to say something about the 5th step. when I did my first fifth step, I had all kinds of stuff on my fourth step for which I was not responsible. And the woman who was hearing my fifth step had the discernment to listen and say, that cross off your list. You are a blameless, vulnerable, dependent child, and that part is not your responsibility. Which allowed me to grow myself up and take responsibility for the pieces for which I was responsible. So I got to separate out the childhood sexual abuse, the growing up with the family disease of alcoholism, the things for which I was blamed inappropriately, and the rage that I carried as an adult. The places where I blamed, the places where I justified bad behavior, defects of character that had been survival strategies that became defects of character. It was an enormous gift that she gave me. And we talk a lot about giving away fifth steps, but what an honor and a privilege it is to hear a fifth step from another woman. I mean, what a sacred trust. And I love to make a safe place and light a candle and just, you know, it's holy. It's really holy, you know, and it does say that we can't stay sober unless we're entirely honest with another person. And I, you know, it's cleansing, it's cathartic, but it's also very bonding between people. So it's an experience that is not to be missed. And in steps 6 and 7, you know, it says the boys from the men, but what does it mean to be a child and what does it mean to be an adult? And my experience is that a lot of times as a child, to have something taken from me, there has to be a consequence. And for me to be an adult, I give it up because I'm just ready to give it up to my higher power. It's like things at work are going well. I'm cash register honest. I punch the clock when I'm supposed to. I do my part. I don't snoopervise other people's parts. I'm gonna give my work to God anyway, even though I keep it between the lines. Like that's the difference between a child and an adult. And how this relates to the concepts is that, you know, as I said in concept one, we are responsible for our own lives, which means I'm not responsible for your life. And I have to give you the dignity of having your own experience and let you live your life as if you have your own higher power. And have this hands-off policy, because when I don't do that, what I'm really trying to do is medicate my own anxiety. And I'm getting into what really is my own step one and unmanageability. So I got to go back to step one and say, I'm powerless over these other people. My life is unmanageable by me. And then look at my defects of character, or sometimes just feelings, because feelings really aren't defects of character. And then tease that out in concepts one and concepts two. And then there's also delegation, like what, and because concept two and concept six and concept, help me, Arisa, the other one that's about delegation. Where have I delegated to you? And then I have to give you the authority to do what you are supposed to do without micromanaging you or doing. And so this like deals with laundry, right? So the other day, my partner, he's like, Nina, do your, you know, go get the laundry. And then he was so mad because she didn't do it right then. She's 10. She's going to do it on her timetable. So we have to give people the space to do things unless we specifically say, would you please do it now? And if you can't do it now, I'm going to do it for you. So let's get into the more juicy emotional stuff. Delegation. Who wants to talk about that? So step eight is an often, it's like, sometimes I say step eight is like the lettuce in a turkey sandwich. No one really gives step eight all that much credit. But it says in the 12 and 12 that step eight, you know, I get on the best possible terms with every single person I know. How is that even possible? You know, and it says this is a moving and fascinating adventure. And so when I did my step eight, I wrote out three columns. And in one column, I said, you know, these are people to whom I'm willing to make my amends right now. If they walked in the door, I would be happy and delighted. And then this second column, I'm sort of there, but not really. And I'll read the literature and talk to my sponsor and get some practice. And then I'd be willing. And the third column is the not no, but hell no column. So then I started making my direct amends. I chose the easier, safer people first, and all that seemed to go pretty well. And then without my permission, the not no column started to migrate over to the willing column. And this brought me to my dear mother. You know, and when I mentioned that treatment experience, I was so glad to go to that family week because my mother was going to end up where she belonged, humiliated in the town square. She was going to be held responsible and accountable for every ugly thing she had ever done. I couldn't wait to see her on the hot seat. She had abandoned me. She had neglected me. When a man raped me, she said, "I read about you and your boyfriend." I mean, I was excited. And then I found out that my mother had been molested when she was 3.5 years old. She had an untreated, undiagnosed mental illness, and that I could take responsibility for my part as an adult. And I read this line that said, "Would I be willing to accept the love she was capable of giving me today? Would I be willing to accept the love she was capable of giving me today?" And I became willing to make direct amends to my mother. So I would call a friend. I would bookend it, as we say, read some literature, talk to an AA friend, go over to her house. You know, the news would be on, Pop would be grilling steaks. The time was never right. And then all of a sudden the time was right. And we were sitting in my library and I had my basket of AA books and she said, "Why do you do all that stuff?" And I said, "Because it makes me feel better. And could I read you something?" And I pulled out a recovery book and I read it to her and I started to cry. And I said, "Mom, I'd like to make my amends for all the harms I have done." And she began to weep and she crawled on the floor over to me and embraced me. And she said, "Honey, I had no idea." And what she meant was that she had no idea what my childhood was like. And she really meant that. I mean, she was so checked out, she had no idea what my childhood was like. And where that relationship went is a place of such tenderness and such intimacy and such beauty and so much unnecessary plastic stuff from Walgreens. Because she thought about me every time she was on aisle 4. And so much food from restaurants, because if they had hot fudge, she wanted me to know that she finally understood that that was my favorite food. And my chosen family, she became mama to them. We were neighbors, and she was either at my house or I was walking around to her back porch barefoot. And she suffered so much from her mental illness that she became a sofa dweller night and day. But when she saw me through that kitchen window, she was on her feet answering that back door. And she would say, "There's my darling, there's my girl, there's my baby." And sometimes it was about all she moved during a day. And when I was campaigning for the candidate of my choice, whom she thought was wackadoodle, and I knew her candidate was wackadoodle, she would come to hear me speak and she'd be all dolled up. She wouldn't hide. She'd have on the full Betty. And she'd watch me speak and she'd come back afterwards to see all the volunteers, many of whom were staying in my house. And she'd say, "Honey, you were perfect. They're so lucky to have you." And you know how I did that? Tradition 4. She got to be autonomous. She got to do it her way. And when she didn't treat her disease in the way that I thought was appropriate, even when I had medical power of attorney, I understood that she had the right to live her life and she had the right to be wrong. And in Concept 7, we talk about traditional rights. So I was traditional in my role as her daughter. And at times I had legal rights as her medical power of attorney. And I would walk this fine line between when do I sign her in to behavioral health, which is also known as the psych unit, and when do I respect her desire not to be signed in, even though I have the legal power to do that. And then I would defer to her marriage with my pop because they had traditional rights as husband and wife. But I could not have done that without Concept 7 and without Tradition 4. And then the political stuff was all about Tradition 10. You know, that was an outside issue. And how do we love and adore each other when we think we're actively doing harm? We go home and we make a donation to our favorite social justice organization. you know, but I also used the general warranties of the conference, which talk about how I don't place myself in unqualified authority over other people. And if I'm constantly imposing my opinion on my mother, with whom I'm rebuilding, not even rebuilding, but having a relationship for the first time, I'm placing myself in unqualified authority over her. You know, when my pop, after mom died, he started doing some stuff that was painful to me in my grief, and he was coping with his grief in his own way. He's autonomous. He gets to do it his way. His grief is an outside issue. I don't get an opinion. And I realized that it wasn't actually what he was doing that was hurting me. It was my opinion of what he was doing that was hurting me. And my friends were being personally punitive. How could Pop do that? I didn't want to be personally punitive. I've had enough loss in my life. I didn't want to ding that relationship. You know, and what he was doing faded. He got past it, and our relationship is fully intact. We text every day. We FaceTime a couple times a week. We travel together. I'm taking him to Vegas to see that little Irish band for his birthday. You know, it didn't cost me anything because I was using the traditions and the concepts in that relationship when his grief diverged from what mine looked like. But it started with step 8. I can have the best possible relations with every human being I know, even my abusers. So another story I want to tell you is that we don't have to have repair in that relationship to have freedom. So I'd known this kid since I was 7 years old, and he raped me in 1998. And I always wondered, because we'd known each other for so long, if there might be a conversation to have someday. I mean, I knew his parents. His brother and I were in advanced reading together in the first grade. There's so much in this world where people who have that kind of male sexual violence cannot come back together. I just thought it was wishful thinking. And I was going to be in his state. And I kept thinking about it. And I had this sponsee who said, God will bless it or block it. And then I was going to be there for a long weekend. And then my Saturday was free. And then someone found him on social media. And then my dad gave me his cell phone number. And then I texted him, and he wrote me right back and was warm and friendly. He said, it's been half a lifetime. And it has. And then I invited him for coffee. And then he said, well, let's not get together in a public place so that people don't bother you. And I said, and the next thing I knew, he came over at 9 o'clock in the morning to a friend's house. And we were sitting in rocking chairs overlooking a creek in Kentucky, which is a place I really like to be. We talked for about an hour, and then I went and prayed up again. I was all prayed up, but I went and I prayed again. And the next thing I knew, I was saying to him, I wonder what story you've carried all these years. And I was like, that was good. I am not responsible for that statement. Where did that come from? And he got very grave and very quiet. And he said, I'd love to tell you what story I've carried all these years. And he told me his story. And of course, it's a little different from mine. Oh, and by the way, my partner had suggested I tell him I came in peace. And I had talked to my sponsor and all that good stuff. And the reason I'm telling you this story is it was really about Tradition 7, which we think of as being financially self-supporting. But I was emotionally self-supporting in that relationship. I did not need anything from him. I did not even need acknowledgement that there was not consent. It was just a conversation. And where that ended up going was he described for him what had happened. I listened. I reflected every word that he said. And then he said, I'm really curious to hear what your experience was. What a gift. I didn't even expect that. I told him my experience, and he said, I did not see you and I did not hear you. I reflected that, and he ended up making his amends. And he said, and my apology will never be good enough. And I said, it's good enough. And I fully accepted his accountability. We ended up saying, I love you. His wife has the same name as I have. We're looking forward to meeting each other's partners and his children. I mean, I've known him since I was 7. But I went in with so much freedom because of the work that I've had the opportunity to do in this program and because of Tradition 7. Because it's about being emotionally and spiritually self-supporting too, and not just financially self-supporting. It was pretty neat. And then there was another piece to the story with which he was not pleased, and I didn't go on a rescue mission and try to rehabilitate the relationship because I can't do someone else's work for them. You know, it would have been so attractive to try to stay in that really sweet place of equanimity that we had achieved together on that day, but I can't rescue anyone from their feelings. He has to refine that for himself. And I just have to let it be. Because he has to be emotionally self-supporting too. So the 10th step is really special to me. Could someone give me a time check, please? I tried to. Thank you so much. So the 10th step is really special to me, and I have the opportunity to talk about that tomorrow night. And you want to talk about using the traditions and the concepts. I mean, the book gives us very nice directions for the 10th step. But the traditions and the concepts help me a lot with that. So I want to talk a little bit about step 11. You know, it says in step 11 that we can select and memorize prayers which emphasize the principles we've been discussing. It does actually say that. It's kind of at the bottom. I don't know how many of us actually latch on to that. But that's exactly what I've done. And I've started with the prayer of St. Francis, which is suggested in the 12 and 12. And so, and it says, you know, there are many books out there. And so what I've done is I've gone to the world's great traditions and lineages and wisdom schools, and I've memorized prayers which emphasize the principles that we discuss in AA. And I just sit with my eyes closed, and I go slowly, word by word, through these prayers, and I let them sink in. And so starting with the prayer of St. Francis, which Bill suggests, it goes very beautifully and calmly and quietly. Make me an instrument. And so that's how I start my day. I do my reading, I do my journaling, and then I say that prayer. And every time I take a nap, I go through that prayer again. And I call it the replacement principle because, it, you know, the quality of thought that I manufacture first thing and I wake up is a little less superior to the prayer of St. Francis and these other prayers that I've memorized. So I just wanted to share that with you. I've come across a couple of other people in AA who do that, but it's kind of a hidden line in the text. And then I was sharing about how it uses the word think, inspiration, so often in that 11th step in the big book. And, you know, it also says we relax, we don't struggle, we take it easy. And Easy Does It is one of our slogans. It's really okay to have peace. It's really okay to be calm. It's really okay to be secure. It's not a requirement to be neurotic and be an alcoholic. You know, it's really okay to have stable relationships that work well. Because when we get to step 12 and have a spiritual awakening and get to practice these principles in all our affairs and carry the message to others, that's what's attractive. You know, that's what Tradition 11 is about, having a life of attraction rather than promotion. And it also says, you know, in step 12 and the 12 and 12, we A's are active folk. We can have beautiful lives in here, and life will still be very lifey, you know. That mom of mine, she ended up dying by suicide, you know, and I found her, and I found her. And I'm so glad I did. And I stand here as a woman who's done a lot of outside work on trauma. I did a specific modality 2 times a week, every week for 4 months. You know, the world has abundantly supplied us with good doctors. We never scoff at a good doctor. And by the way, practicing medicine without a medical license is a Class C felony in most states. It's not recommended we do that on each other in AA. So I don't trivialize the fact that I had significant trauma from finding my mother's body. But the blessing of that experience, you know, of walking in that room and having done the steps and the traditions and the concepts in that relationship was such that when I saw that she had harmed herself, do you know what I said? Mama, I've seen how you've been suffering, and it is okay to go. It is okay to go. And I went over and I just got in the bed with her and I wrapped my arms around her body and I held her. And I talked to her for like 18 minutes. You know, I had to go do that thing and call 911, but I said, y'all sort this out because I want to be with my mother, you know. And I just said, go see your daddy. Go see your brother. I love you. All was forgiven long ago. Be at peace. Go to the mystery. And I just talked to her like that. And it came from the depths of the most authentic place in me. And that is only because those people said to me on the 6th of February in 2006, there is help and hope for a kid like you too. And because when I came in here, I read the literature and Maureen said, go to big book study meetings. And I looked at those stories in the back where everyone has found a God of their understanding. And I was willing to take that eighth and that ninth step with her. And then I used, you know, the traditions and the concepts in our relationship. And it was so sweet and it was so beautiful. And I was there. I was there when she was breathed into the infinite mercy of God. You know, she birthed me into this world and I midwifed her as she left all that pain behind. It is a miracle that that happened. I did not love my mother when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so close to her spirit today. I'll close with this. I had this dream about her the other night. And I've had a lot of love in my life. You know, I loved a husband for 14 years. I'm madly in love with my partner. You know, I had that dog. We've all had that one dog we loved. I've loved little children all over the world. I've loved women in brothels. I've had a lot of love in my life. But I had this dream the other night about my mom. And she was inside of me like butter is inside milk. And it was so prolific and so abundant that color bloomed inside of me. And a garden came up inside of me. And my skin began to grow butterflies and flowers and trees. And I started to talk to her and she started to speak back to me. For a kid who was raised the way I was raised, to have that kind of relationship. We have a fellowship of the spirit in Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you for my miracles. It's really good to be with you tonight. Thank you.